Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
All right, here we go, folks. Welcome to the podcast. Before I get started, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Tommy Chong interview that I last posted last week. I've been getting a ton of listens on that. If you haven't listened to it, check it out. Really, really interesting how we got started with Cheech and Chong, and it's been high ever since. And then pass it along to your friends, because I'm real proud of it. Really cool interview. And keeping with the theme of comedy, we got Bobcat Goldthwait as my guest. Very special show that I'm going to tell you about in a minute. You can see me this weekend, April 27th to the 29th, at Mohegan Sun, at Comics at Mohegan Sun. Go to comicscomedy.com. Four shows, great venue. I've been there before. Come from New England, come from all over, fly in, parachute. They have a parachute drop spot. I don't know what I'm talking about, but just come. April 27th to the 29th, comicscomedy.com. Thanks for checking out Tommy Chong. Spread that around. And my guest, Bobcat Goldthwait. Very special show, though. This is a talk show that I shot in New York City at the Comedy Cellar at the Village Underground. 200-person audience. It's something we're also posting online on YouTube. It's called The Paul Mercurio Show. We did a lot of research, and we figured out that was the best name to go with. It's a really cool conversation with Bobcat about how he got started as a screaming guy, how he's turned the corner and become a different artist, and a whole bunch of hilarious stories along the way. There's comedy in this. This is a special show, and this is the audio from it. I hope you enjoy it, and we're planning to shoot more of these talk shows. Enjoy Bobcat, and thanks again for the mentions on iTunes. If you haven't done so, please go leave a mention. Enjoy this.
Oh, my God. You have the wrong person. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Paul Mercurio Show. Thank you for coming, and thank you for watching at home. Great show tonight. Very excited to have a guy that I've admired for a long time as a comedian, an actor, now a filmmaker, Bobcat Goldthwait, everybody. And we're going to get to Bobcat in a minute, but we'd like to do a little Q&A at the beginning of the show. And so I'm going to open this up to the floor. Anybody have any questions, throw them at me, and we'll have some fun. Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
What advice would you give to someone just graduating college?
Well, I guess if you're asking advice in a basement, that's probably a sign. That you should stay in college a couple more years. The woman next to you, you're really angry about going to school. Look at her. Give her the mic for a minute. Yeah. What's your name?
Wendy.
What's going on? You're pretty. Stand up. Let people see. You're pretty. But you didn't have to do that like you were a hooker. It was like, who wants it in the thing? How was your college experience?
It was great.
Yeah?
Great.
What's your major in?
Broadcasting.
Hey! We should do a thing.
Hey, okay. And you're paying for the thing.
I just read that. Don't be funnier than me. All right, another question. What do we got?
All right, it's my turn.
Where are you? Wow, you sound angry already. Hey, how are you? You have nice teeth.
Thank you. All right, so which do you prefer?
Yes.
A landing strip, a 70s bush, or Telly Savalas? Think about it.
Wendy, what should I answer? Just so I know later what I'm expecting. Which do I prefer? 70s bush, landing strip, Telly Savalas. I gotta say the 70s bush.
What?
No. Hear me out. Hear me out. It's not because I'm a big fan of hair. I just like vaginas that remind me of the carefree days of the Carter administration. Another question. Oh, it's you.
So, boo. Have you ever dated a black woman?
Yes. Yes, and she never went back. I'm kind of cute, right? Would you go out with me?
That Italian thing, yeah.
You like the Italian?
Yeah, the Italian thing is what's so.
Yeah, we'll have sex and then you'll cook. another question? Yes, sir.
Yeah, if you could be a bird for one day, what bird would you be and what would you do for that whole day?
What the fuck is wrong with you?
That's a good question.
I mean, first of all, your eyes aren't completely open. What is going on? Are you always like, look at me, are you always like that?
Yeah, let's stick to the
birds. You look like a professional man with a job and a career and family. And you even sound like a bird the way you said it.
That's why I'm interested. You know, birds have it really tough. People think birds are beautiful. Everybody thinks they want to be a bird because they fly, right? Because they get to shit on people. But birds... I'll let you take over from here. But...
Hang on. Wendy, three-way. He's going to shit on you. How did I lose control of this show?
Why does Wendy get to get shit on?
I'm going to get in the audience, somebody come up here and host the show. Yeah. Who was the one that said, why does... Is that you?
This one, right here.
Wow, you seem dirty. What kind of a bird would I be? I guess I'd be an ostrich.
You should be a phoenix.
I should be a phoenix? Hey, it's my bird, lady. Gentlemen here tonight. You've seen him on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. You have seen him in three comedy specials of his own. He is a filmmaker, an actor, stand-up. His latest film is Willow Creek. He's also known for World's Greatest Dad. Please welcome Bobcat Goldthwait. I
think there's your audience, I think some of them thought I was dead, maybe, but also people aren't used to hearing my real voice.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So that portion of the audience is probably confused too.
Well, you stopped doing the voice a while ago.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because I'm 52, so to still be going,
except on Halloween when you skip frightening children.
Or when I'm injured, you know. or when I'm banging leprechauns. That means nothing to me.
Right, exactly.
We had a heavy leprechaun. Right. Maybe that'll be my next movie. They already did a leprechaun horror picture. Yeah.
They did? I don't know.
What? Three of them, yeah.
Did they really?
Yeah. This one here just said, what was it called? Trying to steer it away from the bird guy.
What about you? You could be a bird?
What kind of bird if I could be a bird? I think I'd be a penguin. Although I like ducks. I had a pet duck, my pet duck Arnold when I was a little boy.
Oh, yeah, that's so cute.
And it was imprinted on me. Like, you know how ducks, waterfowl, a chicken too, the first thing they connect with, it followed me around. And if, like, a dog came, it would sit on my head and stuff, yeah.
To protect you from the dog?
I know, it couldn't talk. It was just a duck. I didn't know what it was doing on my head. I think it was trying not to get eaten.
Well, why a penguin?
Because the males, they sit on the young. I'm not a great father. I just want to crush children with my ass.
Just so people know, if they don't know, tell them how that voice came about.
I think it was just like me not being comfortable on stage and me also really identifying with comedians like Andy Kaufman or Brother Theater, folks who had different personas. So I wasn't really interested in... It's really strange because... I wasn't really interested in being myself on stage now, and it's weird now that I'm this comfortable just talking, which is really weird, because before, if I was on, I would have to feel like I have to get a laugh all the time, but I know that you can cut this all out. No. You know, like, I don't know how entertaining a mentally stable comedian is, you know?
That's sort of the point, in a way. Like, there's this theory, like, you've got to be, you know, if Richard Pryor didn't have a fucked up childhood and blah, 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 do you need that to fuel the comedy? Can you be a functional human being and be a great comedian?
I think, well, I don't know, but I think...
Well, find out.
I think what happens, though, is you get really... You think, like, my anger is what people like, or this character that I do on stage is what people like. So you get so much anger, and you love these character defects, and they block you from actually creating stuff. Like, once I got rid of all this anger, like, after World's Greatest Dad, I actually wrote I wrote 11 screenplays, you know. So I mean, I just write them all the time, you know. And
it's cathartic for you in a way.
It's just, I just get the stories out. I don't know if they'll get made or not, but you know, I once said to my daughter, I go, you know, when I die, all these unmade screenplays are yours. And she goes, Dad, you can't get them made. Why would I want them?
tell them, the folks, the story about your daughter and Russell Brand.
Oh, well.
Hang on.
They're ahead of us. My daughter works as a costumer. She works on movies and television. She was working on this a play reading, and Russell Brand was in it. And I got this emergency text from my daughter, and she said, Dad, there's an emergency. I have diarrhea. I couldn't make it to the bathroom I'm supposed to use, so I went into Russell Brand's dressing room, and I'm in his toilet now. He just came back in, and he doesn't know I'm in his bathroom. What do I do? And I go, make him feel awkward. When you're finished, open the door. I go, hi, Russell Brand. Oh, I'm sorry. I had to change my tampon. Shark Week. And my daughter texts back, Dad, you're the greatest. I love you. Now, she thought I was helping her out of an awkward situation, but really I was like, what could I have her say so Russell Brand won't try to fuck her?
Very clever. It's a good dad. World's greatest dad right there. Started as a stand-up, then an actor, and now he's a filmmaker, and really fearless about decisions. I mean, you know, he did all the major stuff in the Police Academy movie, Scrooge. Yeah, of course. How does that make you feel? Are you okay with, like, I know, because, like, you wanted, this is just
no,
everyone, but,
it's
like...
Just like, I understand there's a lot of people who have a warm feeling about Police Academy, but they weren't in them. No, that's not where I was going. It's just, like, you got to understand. I understand that people like them, but I probably two or three times a day talk to strangers about them, which adds up, and it's usually the same questions. You know, it's, yes, that black guy made those noises. Yeah, you know. You know what I mean? And I try to be polite, but honestly, if I'd known I'd be talking about them every day for the rest of my life, I would have worked harder. I really would have said, this is all I'm going to do. All right, action.
That's it? Okay. Well,
God, if you need me, I'll be in the trailer. Do you want me to do another one? Let's not put our foot through a Van Gogh there, Bob Scratch. I really think you killed it. No, so I don't have a problem with it. I try to be polite.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, I understand if people met me at a wedding, they would talk to me about that wedding that they met me at.
Yeah.
But it feels sometimes a little bit like being on Groundhog Day or something.
They're rebooting Police Academy. They're actually... They're going to do what they did to 21 Jump Street. They're going to make it a comedy.
Wow. What's fascinating to me is you made a conscious decision to take a right turn, if you will, away from success as you were defining it early on in your life. And there's a really interesting quote of yours, which is, I retired from acting the same time they stopped hiring me.
It did work out well, yeah, the
but,
timing.
But following my own thing of making these small indie movies has been the happiest I've ever been, which is profound, and I'm curious as to why are you in that place now? How did you get there?
Well, I mean, you know, most folks aren't, and this isn't me having a pity party, most folks aren't aware that I make movies. My movies make hundreds of dollars. Hundreds. But I can't say that, like, when I was a stand-up comedian and I had these certain things that happened, like having my own HBO special, of course that was a huge deal and it was really exciting. Yeah. But I did get, I got really tired of a lot of different things. I don't really blame typecasting or being pigeonholed. I actually blame myself because I was pursuing things that didn't make me happy. And,
but you didn't know it at the time that they weren't making you happy.
No, but then you kind of buy this whole thing that, like, you know, I'll get rich and famous, and that doesn't really work so well. It maybe does for somebody, you know. But I was very big in the '80s, and it may be depressing to people to find out, but I wasn't that happy being recognized and having people know me and stuff and. But now I write and direct these stories, and if they work for people, that's even better for me. Because, you know, when you're doing stand-up, you have to be funny every 90 seconds. And when you make a movie, you can make it a little bit more about something.
With all of that going on in your career, you did this thing which you call quit hard. Like, and it's like a philosophy of yours. I mean, the quote is like, if it's not making you happy, quit hard.
Yeah, quit until you end up someplace where you don't want to leave. Yeah, yeah. I think in our society, quitting is like admitting defeat instead of not like, instead of a bad choice or a bad situation. So I think, you know, it takes a lot of courage to quit. Yeah, it was late in life this hit me, you know. I had been in a lot of things that weren't making me happy, and I left, and eventually I found this life that I have, and I joke about it a lot, but I am very happy, you know. I mean, usually when someone tells you they're happy, they're not. Like, I'm happy, you know, and they're not. Or when anytime a guy says I'm a good guy. No, he's not. No, he's not. Yeah. I'm a good guy. I'm a decent guy. I used to be a jerk. I'm a good guy.
It's like, I'm a good guy, and then the shitty story comes out right after that shows that he's not a good guy.
Or they jizz in your eye.
Sorry. My uncle used to do that.
I'm a good guy. Why can't we just have a regular birthday clown? So I kind of just got out of that thing, and that made me really happy not to be competing. Like, I'm not competing with any. I don't have another person whose career is similar to mine.
There's no tinge of like 2 weeks after, a month after, like, maybe I should still be.
No. But I, you know, I someone said, because I make about a movie every year to a year and a half, and they said, so which filmmakers are you competing with? And I'm like, I'm competing with the Grim fucking Reaper. That's who I'm competing. You know, I'm trying to get as many made as I possibly can. But, you know, and so myself, I kind of was, my back was against the wall. And I went back to, well, I wondered if I could even write a screenplay anymore when I wrote Stay, which became Sleeping Dogs Lie, and then it got into Sundance. But, you know, I shot that with a crew from Craigslist, you know? And I shot it for $20,000. And I guess I can tell this story now. We were filming a scene in a garage, and the house that we're supposed to film the scene in, the house fell through. So across the street was a home that was for sale, and it was empty. So so I broke the lock off the door of the on the garage, and brought the whole crew in, and the crew was all these young kids who were in college, and I go, we have to be really quiet tonight. This is a really sensitive scene. We have to be really concerned for the actors. And one of the kids on the show goes, you don't have a permit this time, do you? And I go, dude, I don't know whose fucking house this is.
You're gonna get it done at any cost. But it's also, I think, see, I feel like you're a filmmaker now, but at your core, and you know, you tell me if I'm wrong, you are a stand-up. And even in your directing and your experiences, from what I know, you know, you're sort of defiant at times, anti-authoritarian. Tell the story. Your first legitimate gig into directing was Jimmy Kimmel. Is that right?
I did some other stuff, but I was the director on the Kimmel Show for 3 years, and then I left. I was like, this guy's going nowhere. He's holding me back. No. Actually, I'll be on the show. I'm actually a guest really soon. I directed that show and people don't know that, but I was the guy in the booth going, ready, camera one, camera five, that whole thing.
And tell them the story. This is where I think that through and through, you're always a stand-up. The one about Nickelback?
Let me back up. The band Nickelback, they're probably nice guys. I don't know. I didn't meet them when I was directing the show, but their road manager or manager, he came into the booth and he goes, who's the director? And I go, oh, I am. And he goes, yeah, don't shoot Chad profile. And I go, who's Chad? He goes, that's our lead singer. I go, why can't I shoot him profile? He goes, because he has a large nose. And I was like, and the cameraman could hear this conversation on the headphones. And I go, okay, I won't shoot him. I won't shoot him profile. And then the camera guys are going, pussy. And and so if you've ever seen the Kimmel Show, the band will do one song and then they do one more song as they go off the air. And I said to the assistant director, I go, tell me when we have 10 seconds left, because they're doing the second song. I go, tell me when we have 10 seconds left. She goes, 10 seconds. And I go, shoot the nose. And seven cameras. They zoomed in from every angle, up his nose, down. It was, I was like, and then I made a montage. I made a nose montage. I was like, camera five, camera three, ready six, ready one, two, four. And it was like, ding, 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 ding. And then we went off the air, and it was dead quiet in my headset. And I hear the crew go, what are we going to do now? And I was like, I'm getting in my car.
So your definition of success early on is different than what it is now. And you've talked about in your stand-up that there were three phases of stand-up for you, or are. One is, can I do it? Then it was, I have to do it. And now, present day, it's, I want to do it.
Yeah.
And the can I do it, like, which was crazy when I found this out, started really young for you. When you were a kid and you thought, that might be the thing.
Yeah, I started doing stand-up comedy when I was 15.
But you were 7 when you saw Carlin.
Yeah, I saw Carlin like when I was 7 years old. And I asked my mother, George Carlin was on TV during the daytime. And I said, I was so homesick from school. And I go, what does he do for a job? What does he make? How does he make a living? And my mother goes, oh, that's what he does for a living. I was like, oh, this is great. You know, like I got to figure out how to do this. At that point, that's when my grades went down, you know. Yeah.
First grade.
Yeah, I was like, I'm out. I got to work on my...
And you were just going to a tough school. You're going to a Catholic school with nuns. And you had some issues with the nuns. Right?
Well, but I... I met my best friend when I was 6 years old, who's Tom Kenny, who's the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants, and I met him. I don't want to name drop, but I know SpongeBob. But we met in first grade. There was a nun that was my teacher, and I made her cry. And
wait, what did you do to make her cry?
I don't want to get into that now. No, I really don't remember. I was really precocious, you know, and I think it had to do with, I knew that Jesus' real birthday wasn't Christmas, and I think that was the straw that broke her back, you know. So I was just a jerk when I was a kid. So I'm a nice guy now. So when I was a little boy, I made this nun cry, and then she dragged me across the hall and put me into Tom Kenny's classroom with his sister and said, she was crying, I was crying at this point too, and she's like, I can't take him anymore, and she left me in the classroom, and I felt really horrible, and then Tom Kenny thought it was really cool that I could make a grown nun cry, so he introduced himself at lunch, and then that's how we became friends.
Wow.
He just thought... He said, I'm going to either be this guy's friend or he'll destroy me. So we must become... No, so yeah. So, and even as kids, we kind of knew what we were doing. We should have listened to our voices then, because when we were like in high school, Tom Kenny, he had Mel Blanc up in his locker, you know, like, yeah, that was like, and pictures of olive oil. He was kind of Popeye's girlfriend. He was kind of horny for olive oil. It was really weird.
Wow. I'd be afraid of breaking her.
And he later married Shelley Duvall. No.
You were doing a thing, for lack of a better term, sort of deconstructing comedy in your teens. You really started to gravitate. You're 7, you're Carlin, and then you're listening to Cosby, and then eventually Andy Kaufman and Steve Martin. And tell people, like 13, 14 now, you're starting to perform as a stand-up. You're also in a punk band. But like, what was your comedy like then?
The original acts was very, I don't know. It was just me trying to be silly and goofy. But then as I got a little older, like when I was about 18 or 19, I kind of was fed up with stand-up comedy. My act was really weird, you know. Like I would go on stage and I'd say, oh, thank you. It feels really good to be here. And then I'd start crying. And then I would pull out a Dear John letter and I would read it. It was a real Dear John letter too, by the way. And then I would just go back doing my act. You know, I go, my wife is so fat. And someone goes, how fat is she? I go, I told you I don't even have a girlfriend. Why are you, you know? And it'd just be tears, you know? And then once I started doing the persona that people kind of knew me for, I would come out of that and I'd say, this is a part of the show where I like to gut and clean fish. Does anyone have any fish? And my roommate would pull out like big fish that we would buy in the market. And then
a legitimate fish.
Yeah, he would just happen to have like a giant, you know, fish. And one time it was kind of rancid because it'd been in the trunk of a car, and I gut it open, and immediately this woman vomited on contact when I went. And there's fish guts, and I put the mic down so you can hear it going,
Let's help her. You're like, oh, this will add to the bit.
Yeah. And so, and I go, you've been a great crowd. Good night. And there's fish guts. And then the next comedian who came out, and he's like, hey, relationships are weird. You know, where? And it was at the Ding Ho Comedy Club in Massachusetts, outside of Boston. And Shun Li, who was a Chinese gentleman who owned the club. It was the only time he spoke to me. He just said, Bobby, you weird. You weird. just mad that they had to clean up stuff. Really, but I even did weirder stuff like that. You know, I know people, I toured, this wasn't weird for me, but I toured as an opening act for Nirvana, which people don't know. Yeah.
That's ballsy. I got some friends that go out with like these heavy rock bands. It's like, how do you? That's
because I didn't go like I didn't think I was gonna go out there and they go. As soon as they get a load of my jokes, they're gonna forget all about this Nirvana. You know, it's some nights it went well, some nights it went horrible, but it was fun for me both ways.
Did you have a tell me about the person that got thrown at you?
I got hit by a teenager. Yeah, like. People talk about heckling. They successfully threw a kid out of the pit at me, and he hit me by the back of the knees, and then he just scrambles off like, ah! And I had like M80s go off by my head. I would, and then on New Year's Eve, we were at the Oakland Coliseum, and because it's New Year's, it was just so I rappelled in nude from the roof of the Oakland Coliseum.
What?
Yeah, at midnight. I said like,
yeah, at midnight. That makes it rational.
Yeah. It wasn't weird. It was midnight. You know.
What was the conversation like when they proposed that to you? Was there
no? They
like...
didn't propose it. We were like, we got to do something special, and I know people. Find this weird to find out that like Kurt was a fan of my stand-up, and that's why I was doing that. I met them before they were famous. They had recorded Bleach, and he gave me that CD.
Where did you first meet him?
He interviewed me in a college radio station in Ann Arbor, and
really,
and that's how we met. And I remember listening to it and going, "Boy, these guys are pretty good." You know, it really sucks to be in a rock band. You know, and then like a year and a half later, I'm getting hit with bottles opening for him. But by the way, if you're going to be naked at midnight or anywhere, give it a tug. I looked, it was not flattering. I've seen the photos. And.
Well, it had more sense than you. Your penis
was
scared.
Probably inside.
Because your penis is like, this is fucked up. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm getting out of here.
Well, so it's midnight and I'm repelled and I'm holding my own weight with a cable. And Kurt's supposed to count down. And then finally he goes, one. And I shot down really fast and I landed behind him. And I came down so fast, I got a rope burn on my ass and stomach, but I hit the stage. So then I went to get my clothes, which was supposed to be behind this amp, and it was all gone because everybody, you know, thought that was funny. And so I learned this, though. If you're naked at midnight, you don't get a kiss. Like, people were like, whoa, nude guy walking through. Like people were making a circle wherever I went.
So are you, is there sort of, around this sort of
I was just thinking of my daughter during that, you know, like, because... Because she would always, like, I had set the Arsenio Hall show on fire. I set the Tonight Show on fire, but I smashed up the Arsenio Hall show.
You spray painted on it because you were upset that they were...
Well, I thought it was funny because he got axed by Paramount, so I spray painted Paramount Sucks on the set. So I smashed up the Arsenio Hall show and I smashed a lot of things up on that program. And
why?
It's just over show business, and
were you just was this like the run where you're because you've talked about your anger and stuff?
Yeah, I said I'm very angry, and I also
what were you angry about at that time?
I honestly think like you get into this position where you think you should be doing better or have a different right. career, and I got tired with the fact like I could do really well with an audience, but it didn't seem to matter. It didn't forward my career.
Does the anger go back to when you were getting thrown out of class at 7 with the nuns? And I mean, and I don't mean that as a joke.
No,
like, were you angry as a kid?
I was always angry, but I wasn't at the same time. I was very angry, but I was never. I shouldn't say never, but most of the time I wasn't a bully. I didn't really. I always kind of identified with the weirdos and the outcasts, you know. I wasn't like somebody who picked on other people.
Well, I mean, it's not, from what I understand, you know, your parents were really cool. Your dad was a sheet metal worker. You came from a great home. In fact, your dad sounded hilarious because he would do these...
He was a very skits. Odd duck, my father. He was like a performance artist, a suburban performance artist, because... He did these concept ideas, but they were all fueled by Budweiser, or actually by Jenny Cream Ale, because we were from Syracuse. My dad would do things like he would be kind of hammered, and then he would usually make some sort of homemade costume, like a cape and rubber pants. Like he'd cut off the legs on waiters, and then he'd climb on top of the refrigerator. He'd like open a jar of mayonnaise from inside the refrigerator, and then he'd put it on the floor, and then climb on top of the refrigerator, and he would convince everyone he was going to dive into the mayonnaise jar. But he would do this, and his commitment was really serious, and he would let all the neighborhood kids in, and they would watch this, and he would do this for hours, and then eventually be like, it's Hellman's. I can't do it with Hellman's. Yeah, he would do a lot of really odd things.
Did that influence your sort of, you know, the years when you were sort of deconstructing comedy?
Well, when I was a kid, I would just watch that and thought, well, that's how you were funny, that it wasn't really based on jokes, just making people feel awkward and weird, yeah.
You definitely gravitated, and I want to talk about this part of your life, your childhood, sort of to worlds of anger, if you will. You're in a punk band, and I want to talk to you at the when you were 14, and in fact, I actually want to interview you as 14-year-old Bobcat.
Say hi to 14-year-old Bobcat, everybody. Adorable. So, Bobcat, thanks for being on the show. You're 14.
Fuck you! Go fuck yourself.
You seem a bit angry. What are you angry about?
Why am I angry? I look like a girl.
Have you begged your parents for a better haircut?
I thought this was actually before I found punk rock. This haircut, I like this haircut because I really like a lot of I like a lot of punk rock bands like Blondie.
Well, you're 14, you're in high school, right? So you're a Catholic high school, right? Do you get along with the nuns?
Most of the time, Tom Kenny and I got in trouble because we made posters and hung them up all over the school for a nun wrestling tournament. Where the Sisters of St. Francis against Sisters of St. Joseph's and a no-holds-barred grudge match. And the weird part, out of all the stuff I've done, that was the thing I got in the most trouble with. I don't know why. I really don't know why, because I did a lot worse things.
What were some of the other things you did?
Going out with a couple of cars, and we went and stole all the real estate signs in town, and then pounded them in the front yard of our school. I mean, that's just cute stuff.
So are you angry at this age? You seem a bit like whatever.
I don't know. Am I angry here? Yeah, actually I am. At this point, I'm the lead singer of a band called the Dead Ducks.
Yeah, talk about that. How did you get into the punk scene, and what drew you to it?
When I was a kid, just seeing like bands like the Ramones and stuff like that, you know. So that really changed everything. I don't know if you want me to say this now. But
you were busting balls in the band, too. Like, you would, like, joke between songs and bust.
Yeah, I mean, once I got kicked out of all these bands or left these bands, I was doing...
Is there anything you didn't get kicked out of?
No. I mean, there's a lot more, you know. Like, I realize there's a pattern with me. And then I say, and then I got arrested, or then I had to go away. You know, I mean, yeah, it is a pattern.
But what is it? It seems like you kind of get into a place of comfort and then you got to shed it and you get uncomfortable. Is it? Do you have any sense of why that sort of...
I think early on in my life, up until not even that long ago, it was being self-destructive. And now it's not that at all. It's taken me almost... Well, it probably took me 28, 29 years to figure out what I want to do, you know, and it ends up being telling stories, writing stories, and filming. And
one of the big moments, like you talked about Arsenio, but like another place where it sort of seemed to, I don't know, change for you, is you go on the Leno show, like the set on fire.
Yeah, I set it on fire, yeah. But, you know, in my defense, in my defense, it was cold. The weird part, I think Leno got most angry when I was on the show because he's like, "Yo, what happened? What happened over there on Arsenio Hall?" You know, and I said, "Well, it worked." And he goes, "What do you mean it worked?" I go, "Well, I'm here." And then he got really weird. And then I did pour lighter fluid, and I shouldn't have done it. Maybe in hindsight, but
maybe.
Well, I mean, I didn't really. I mean, I knew, like, I had my friend standing by a fire extinguisher in case it didn't burn out, but...
I love how you rationalize stuff.
Well, you know, here's the part that I don't like. The part I don't like is that it was definitely an aggressive F you to Jay. And all he wanted was to have me on the show. Yeah. So that part's not cool. Yeah. But setting a Tonight Show on fire, I mean, I grew up watching, you know, Keith Moon and Jimi Hendrix. So to me, it didn't seem that weird.
So is this, is it like, you know, you just are bored with the form and want to try something else? Or are you angry? Or are you sort of...
A little column A, a little column B.
Yeah. And maybe also like, I'm on the big stage and I got to do like what all the other big comedians do. And maybe you don't want to be compared to their performances, so I'm going to do this other thing that kind of separates me from them?
No, it wasn't even that, because at that point I'd been on a bunch of talk shows and stuff. It was really just kind of like...
Yeah, Letterman was your big first...
Yeah, I got on Letterman when I was 20.
The Leno thing is column A, column B. It's a mix of those things, and then...
It's interesting, because I did it when people still liked Leno. You know what I mean? So people were insane. Yeah. Like, why did you do that? You caught the brass ring. Why would you do that? And fear, anger, you know. But Leno was screaming at me. They cut that out of the broadcast.
What did he say?
Well, he's like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" You know, and it's just, it's so weird to hear.
Because he's generally...
Yeah, you would never see him say, "Fuck." It was really weird. Like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" You know. When he gets going, he sounds like Dino. You know, like, no.
Was there backlash from that in your career? Like, was it tough to get booked?
No, the opposite thing was. After I did that, like, everybody wanted me on the show.
Does anybody have lighter fluid?
That's 100% true. Like, I was on Regis and Kathy Lee after that. I was on the Larry Sanders show, and I was talking to Shandling, and he's like, I go, "Well, I'm going to be on Kathy Lee and Regis and Kathy Lee." That was the name, right? Yeah. And He goes, well, what are you going to do on that? I go, well, I think I'm going to have a big meal, and then I'm going to put Epicac in my coffee mug. That's the stuff that induces vomiting, you know. And so just go, hey, how's your children? How's Cody? And then take a big pull, and then I thought I'd vomit on Kathy Lee Gifford, right? And I just thought that'd be funny, right? So I tell Gary Shandling this story, and he's like, oh, that's great, you know. Can we put that on the Larry Sanders Show? I go, but I want to do it on the real show. So we filmed me telling that story. So I show up to do the show, and they pat me down. They go, hey, we saw Larry Sanders. And I go, come on, that was something in a screenplay, you know. That was that. I didn't. And then they find the Epicac in my coat pocket. And then I go out and they go, hey, we're going to give you a fire extinguisher, because it was right after I set the Tonight Show on fire. And they go, we're going to give you a fire extinguisher on the air. Is that okay? And I go, yeah, that's fine with me. And before they could give it to me, I walk over, I pulled a pin out and just shot Regis with it. And he ran off the set. And then Kathy Lee Gifford ran up into the audience, and I fired it up her skirt. And then... And I had taken my shirt off, and I had the mic on my nipple, and they said it was the highest rating spike in the history of the show. Because, you know, people were at home going, what the hell is that asshole doing? You know, honey, get in here.
You know? I don't know, but I can't take my eyes off the screen.
So I did have to say that there was a period where I kind of didn't care at all. Or maybe I did. Maybe I cared too much and I was being angry. But it was like, I thought, well, you could do prepared material or you could do thought out material. But then I kind of was kind of thinking, what if we just bring some anarchy? You know what I mean?
But here's the thing, the thing that I always try to figure out is,
I had set a show on fire in Australia and I didn't get in any trouble.
Well, that's the place to go then.
No, I set this guy's notes on fire. I doused it with lighter fluid and I go, do you have a match? And he actually did. And he goes, how's this trick work? I go, I'm setting your desk on fire.
Were they cool with it? Jay Leno came out, what the fuck are you doing? He
pops out like whack-a-mole, you know.
You make this shift over away, you know, from sort of the mainstream success that you have, for lack of a better term, and as we said at the beginning of the show, happy. And you start making these films that are very personal to you, and you've kind of decided, okay, I'm gonna stop doing things that I think other people want and do what I want to do.
But to truly do what I want to do, instead of doing what was a reaction to them not accepting me, you know?
Explain that.
Well, when you set the Tonight Show on fire, I'm doing what I want to do. But I'm really doing it as a reaction to in my mind, you know what I mean? And instead of, now when I make these movies, and I know I don't mean it this way, but there's no market for the movies I make, you know what I mean? I truly make them for myself first, and if people enjoy them, that's awesome. Often when I'm making my movies, like my movies, but I know I sound like a blowhard, but I choose to write screenplays, and if people aren't interested in making them the way I wrote them, I'd rather not make the movie than
I don't know if I could do that. I'd be like, please, I gotta get it made. Like, you don't want to compromise.
No, I mean, I'd rather, because I did that already, you know?
Yeah.
You're in a talking horse movie. You don't want to go back. You know? So
you have some, but you have integrity.
Well, no, but I have the integrity you have at the beginning of your career, at the end of my career. I already sold out as a young man. I have a dyslexic integrity. Yeah.
What was it about Willow Creek is your movie that's out now, and you can see it on iTunes. It's really great. I know other people have seen it here. And it's about Bigfoot. It's not a doc, but there are some real people from this area, Willow Creek. Tell people what Willow Creek is and where it is and why you became fascinated with the subject matter.
Well, it's a Bigfoot movie, and Jimmy Kimmel calls it Scary in the Hendersons. And it's Willow Creek is the town that the Patterson-Gimlin footage of Bigfoot walking and turning back. It's the town where that was made. And so I shot a movie with real people, and then the actors are playing a real couple. And it is a suspense movie, and it is a scary movie, but it's also... I try to play it realistically and not make fun of people who believe in Bigfoot.
Yeah, you didn't do that, to your credit. You could have easily gone down that road. Well, you have a lot of knowledge of Bigfoot, and as a result of making the movie. And what we're going to do is we're going to read some scenarios from actual fans who've written in, emailed, social media, question scenarios of what to do when confronting Bigfoot, and you're going to give him some advice.
All right.
And I'll try to help out as well. And this is a little something we like to call Bobcat, what the big fuck do I do? We'll start. Here we go.
This question is from Tom in Boulder, Colorado. When you're camping, how high up in a tree do you need to keep your food away from Bigfoot?
I've seen footage of Bigfoot in trees, so I guess you're fucked, is what it is.
Next one.
Robert in Amherst, Massachusetts wants to know, you walk into your room and find Bigfoot in your bed with a belt and a plastic bag. What do you do?
Join him?
Next one.
Kevin in Lusk, Wyoming. You're the director of the Jimmy Kimmel Show, and the booker has mistakenly booked Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster onto the same show. Which monster do you cancel?
Well, that's ridiculous. The Loch Ness Monster's not real.
Bobcat Goldthwait, everybody. Thank you, man. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for watching. Check out Willow Creek on iTunes. And thanks again. Good night, everybody. That's our show.
How cool was that? I'm very proud of it. If you didn't like it, there's something wrong with you. If you did, I love you. I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to do more of these live talk shows, but Bobcat seemed like a perfect person to do one with. He's got such an interesting career, and I still love the story about his father pretending to jump into mayonnaise. April 27th to the 29th, I'm going to be at Comics Comedy Club at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut. So come hang out, comicscomedy.com for tickets, Mohegan Sun, April 27th to the 29th. Thanks again for checking out the podcast, and we'll see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.